This show furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervy. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Kerry Kaysen. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervy and Kerry Kaysen.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all around the world, right here on KBC.com. If you're not in the 790 area, I know you can hear me. I'm Alan Gervy, and I am the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. And today, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. Yes, I am a control freak, and I'm here with another control freak who's laughing. It's so nice to have back with us on Gervy's Law, Kerry Kaysen.
Oh, Alan, it's so great to be back. Yes, I haven't heard that opening in a little while now.
Well, you don't listen to the show when you're not on the show?
Sometimes I don't.
Oh, come on. Last week we had a great show. You missed that show with Scott Gariola, the FBI special agent.
I did.
Who apprehended Whitey Bulger.
You know, I have been gone and traveling for 5 weeks. So I have to come back and catch up. There are shows, of course. I go back and I listen to, and they're phenomenal, and I wish I was there. There's a few of them. I'm actually very jealous that you did them or you had another co-host in, which was very upsetting.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to make you jealous. But today's a show where I'm sure you're happy you're here because last time when our guest was here and Alan Gervy, that's me, went one-on-one with Tom Mesereau, Kerry Kaysen wasn't here. But today she made sure she's here. She wouldn't miss it for anything. And we want to welcome to the show, it is Tom Mesereau. He's one of America's 100 most influential trial lawyers by Trial Lawyers, National Trial Lawyers Organization. Listed him as one of the 100 most influential attorneys in California. That was Los Angeles Daily Journal. He's had just about every accolade. He's probably like more interesting than that Dos Equis guy. You know that guy on
TV? He had the most interesting man in the world.
Yeah, we have him here today. He is not that guy who sits in the booth at that restaurant or wherever he is with that smile. We have the man right here. In fact, Lori Levinson, who's often quoted in the media, she's a professor of Loyola Law School, called Tom Mesereau the best cross-examiner she has ever seen. And that was, of course, referring to some of his celebrity clients, which have included Michael Jackson, Mike Tyson, Robert Blake, Suge Knight, and a host of others. And he's also been very successful with white-collar crime as well as blue-collar crime. We're going to talk a little bit about that today. We're going to talk a lot about his cases, his theories, his strategies. Tom Mesereau, welcome back to Gervy's Law.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very honored to be here again.
And it's so nice to see you all dressed up. I know it's a Saturday, but you're still in your suit. You're working 7 days a week. A criminal lawyer's job is never done, is it?
No, it's not. You've got clients whose lives are on the line, and the stakes are very high, and you've got to be readily available and put them in a high priority in your life.
And you know, we talk about lawyers being good people, and one of the things we've learned from Gervy's Law, at some of the most famous lawyers are really good-hearted people. We've had Jerry Spence on the show, F. Lee Bailey, Alan Dershowitz, Gloria Allred, a lot of them high-profile attorneys, but we see a different side to them. Everyone sees a different side to you when you do pro bono cases. And we want to talk a little bit before we get moving on to some of your other cases about the pro bono work that you've done over the last 18 years.
Well, I've been going down south in Alabama and Mississippi for the last 18, 19 years and doing at least one pro bono murder case a year. They're usually capital murder cases where someone potentially could face the death penalty. I started doing it almost 19 years ago when I agreed to defend pro bono a homeless black man who was charged with murdering a white girl from a prominent family. I took the case, and then one thing led to another. He was acquitted. This was the first time anyone had called an eyewitness identification expert who specialized in cross-racial eyewitness identification. I called that expert in that trial. I also defended someone named Wesley Quick, who spent 6 years in Alabama's death row, convicted of a double murder that he did not commit. I agreed to come in and do the retrial. He was acquitted, and I'm very honored that this case is mentioned in the National Registry of Exonerations of the University of Michigan and Northwestern University Law Schools. And I just tried a pro bono murder case in Birmingham.
That was the Odell Allen case.
Yes, it was not a capital case. He wasn't facing the death penalty, but he was facing life in prison.
And of course, you got him off.
Well, I don't like the term got him off.
I knew. I said to him last time he got him off. You know, of course, the legal word is acquitted, but tell us what happened.
Well, it was a self-defense case. There had been some arguments and squabbles and pushing and shoving with various family members. The person who was shot then came onto his property. There was conflicting testimony as to who went for a gun or didn't go for a gun. But to make a long story short, we claim self-defense. I put the client on the stand. He explained what happened. Our biggest obstacle was that there was a close-range shot to the chest and 3 shots to the back. So the prosecutor was screaming that the 3 shots to the back showed something more than self-defense, that this was a revenge type of situation. The jury was very, very diligent. They were read the jury instructions on what self-defense is in the state of Alabama, and after they were read those instructions 3 times, they wanted them read back, so they didn't make a mistake, and they did acquit him and found self-defense.
Now, when you pick these cases, or do people pick you, do they come to you?
I have a friend named Charlie Salvaggio in Birmingham, a great trial lawyer who I've been friendly with now for 19 years. We have periodic discussions about what case I will join him in. Mm-hmm. So typically I do it with him. There's another criminal defense lawyer, great lawyer named Wilson Myers, who I've also handled a few cases with in Birmingham. But we have a great respect for one another, a good friendship, a good professional relationship. We work well, and we decide jointly what case I will take each year pro bono.
Do they have an innocence project thing like that out in Alabama, where you know there's already so much evidence that points to the fact that this person could be innocent? Do you pick those cases, something like that?
I don't work with the Innocence Project per se. Okay. There, of course, I have tremendous respect for that organization. What Barry Scheck and other diligent lawyers have done is unbelievable. But I do it at the trial level. They typically take it post-conviction. I try cases. I'm not a post-conviction lawyer, so I like to get in front of juries and handle that portion of the case.
How do criminal lawyers get paid when the accused has no money?
Well, in Birmingham, Alabama, they're appointed, and they get court-appointed fees. Judges have a certain discretion in appointing lawyers to defend cases. But whatever I do for free. I pay my own airfare, I pay my hotel bill, and I get no legal fees. Mm.
Do you do that so that you can elevate your name, so that you can get the paying customers?
No, I do it because I think I owe it to the profession. And I think as lawyers, we're blessed to have a great credential, a great opportunity to make a good living. And I think we owe it to our profession and to society to try and give something back.
Tell us about the Mesro Free Legal Clinic in South Los Angeles.
Well, since the early 90s, I have volunteered at free legal clinics throughout Los Angeles. I, for many years, would volunteer at the First AME Church Free Legal Clinic. I volunteered at other churches, clinics where lawyers and law students and college students, activists, would donate their time to help those in need. And after the Michael Jackson victory, with all the accolades I got, I decided to open the Mesro Free Legal Clinic. It operates out of Morningside Church, which is at Crenshaw in Manchester. Again, lawyers, law students, college students, people interested in helping the community, all volunteer. And we do everything we can for people who need advice, need someone to talk to. And sometimes we actually take the case, sometimes we don't. But we're there to talk to. And we think it's a valuable, you know, opportunity for us, as well as the people who need help. There are no losers, only winners in this situation.
That makes a lot of sense.
It does. I want to go back a little bit about what you said about, and I wrote it down here, it's a cross-race eyewitness expert. Can you explain what that is?
Yes. What I did in my first, actually it was my second capital murder trial in Alabama. The first one I signed up for was defending a homeless black man charged with killing a beautiful white girl from a prominent family, and There was a lot of racial tension surrounding the case. Two white lawyers were appointed to defend him. They were getting messages on their machine that they're nigger lovers, things like that. They asked me to help them, and I said I would. And I had used eyewitness identification experts before in California. An eyewitness identification expert is very often a psychologist or a social scientist who is very familiar with the literature involving eyewitness identification. And there is a particular sector of eyewitness identification called cross-racial eyewitness identification. And the studies consistently show that when someone of one race identifies someone of another race in a crime situation, they tend to be very, very unreliable identifications. For some reason, blacks identifying whites, whites identifying blacks, whites identifying Asians, Latinos identifying Asians, that kind of thing. These are very inaccurate eyewitness identifications to the point where they've done studies of white children who went to predominantly black schools from an early age. And even in those situations, they don't do any better in the identifying exercises that are the subject of these studies. So juries tend to be very much affected by an eyewitness. If somebody gets on the witness stand and points to the defendant and says, that's him, I'll never forget his face, juries tend to be very affected.
Sure.
And yet the studies show that these kinds of identifications are often very unreliable, that given the stress of a situation, the lighting factors, the stress, there's another factor called weapon focus. People who see a weapon focused at them tend to focus on the weapon and not the face of the one holding it.
Makes sense.
Many factors go into the unreliability of these identifications. But I discovered that in Alabama, nobody had ever called an eyewitness identification expert in a capital murder case before, so I was the first one. You had two white girls were bar hopping one night. They parked in a churchyard. They went back to get in the car, got in their car, and a black man pointed a gun at the passenger and said, both of you give me your purses, or words to that effect. They gave the purses. They were allowed to drive off, but the girl driving the car was furious, and she did a U-turn and crashed her car into the gunman's car, and she was then shot to death. So you had a surviving young white girl who identified this homeless black man as the shooter. And we showed that the conditions under which she made this identification were less than ideal, to say the least. People will remember a few features, and then because they want certainty in their mind, they will fill in the other features based on stereotypes they know about. So we did call the expert, and fortunately there was an acquittal, because I know this man was absolutely innocent.
Wow. That's really fascinating stuff. You know, we have a lot to talk about. I want to talk a little bit after the break about when justice isn't just. If you're talking about race relations, it's a real predominant theme in our society today. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan Gervie and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan Gervie and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervie and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
Hiring people is probably the worst part of my job. It's such a hassle, the searching, the sorting through resumes. Most people don't have the right experience.
We started using ZipRecruiter about 3 months ago. Right from the start, you could tell it was going to make hiring a lot easier. One click and my job was posted to 100 plus job boards, all the top sites.
All of the candidates came to my dashboard, and it's easy to compare them. Thumbs up if I liked them, thumbs down if I didn't. No emails and attachments, printing up docs, phone calls, none of that.
And I couldn't believe the number of great applicants we got. I had the person we needed within 1 week. I don't know how we hired before ZipRecruiter.
Whether you're looking to fill one position or 20, find the best candidates with ZipRecruiter. where your job is just one click away from 100-plus job sites. ZipRecruiter, the fastest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/talkradio. That's ZipRecruiter.com/talkradio. ZipRecruiter.com/talkradio.
The Kings get set to drop the puck on their 50th season.
Heading Jet Royale, Convoy Flat, and Frenchie Lemieux for the Kings.
And the only way to celebrate a golden anniversary is by raising a silver cup.
Score! Kings win the game!
Wednesday night, the Kings face off against the Western Conference champion San Jose Sharks. Coverage gets underway at 7 with Inside Kings Hockey. Kings. Sharks, Wednesday at 7, on your home for the 50th season of LA Kings Hockey.
Go, Kings, go!
790 KABC.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
And we are back. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. We are talking with the Trial Lawyer of the Year for 2015, named by the National Trial Lawyers Association. Judge Lloyd Nash of the LA County Superior Court called Tom Mesereau one of the finest lawyers I have ever seen after watching Mr. Mesereau cross-examine prosecution witnesses in the Robert Blake murder case. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about race relations. And Tom, you were involved in a documentary called Justice Isn't Just. What was that all about?
I think it was called When Justice Isn't Just. And it was a documentary about the inner city, about problems that African-American people face in trying to get justice, trying to get equality, trying to get fairness. They did come to the Mesereau, those who filmed the documentary did come to the Mesereau Free Legal Clinic and heard a number of speakers, including one federal judge, speak about what's wrong with the drug laws and how African-Americans, particularly low-income African-Americans, are discriminated against in drug prosecutions. And it surveys a lot of people in the inner city, parents of children who've been slain, people who are activists in the community concerned about unfairness by the police. And it's meant to be a very good, in-depth look at the inner city and the problems that poor people have, particularly poor African-American people have in facing justice.
Now, you recently spoke at the Cal State University Long Beach protest regarding police brutality. What is your take on that? Because it's been in the news. We had Larry Elder on the show not too long ago, and Larry, he blames the black community on a lot of these issues for not being able to elevate themselves above it.
Well, what I said to the students was the following. To have credibility when you go after police misconduct and police abuse, you must also recognize those very courageous and very honorable and very professional police officers who do their job to protect all of us. If you recognize the good ones, you will have more credibility in attacking the bad ones. And there are definitely bad ones. There are people like you saw in New York, where a father of five children is selling allegedly illegal cigarettes, hardly a violent, threatening crime, and you see five police officers go after him. He doesn't resist, he doesn't run away, and he's strangled to death, a father of five children. You see that black man in South Carolina who's talking to a white cop. We don't know what they're saying. He's pulled over for some minor traffic violation. He starts to run, the cop shoots him in the back, and then you see police officers try and plant some evidence to sanitize the crime scene.
Tom, isn't
these are bad cops.
I understand that, but isn't it true that there are bad people in every profession? Alan Dershowitz was on the show a few weeks ago. He said there are so many unethical lawyers. He really wants to write a book and name names of unethical lawyers. Why are the cops being singled out? Do you agree with Colin Kaepernick's protest?
I do agree with his protests. I think it's a courageous move on his part. But look, you talk about bad people in every profession. Of course they exist, but not every profession gives you deadly force and lets you use it when you choose. Police officers have a very tough job. very tough job. They deal with crime on an almost hourly basis. It's very difficult sometimes to determine if someone's going for a gun or not. We have to recognize the good ones, the ones who are courageous, honorable, selfless, who protect us, but we also have to condemn the bad ones who are, act like criminals with badges. Both exist.
Is taking a knee during the national anthem the correct means to do this protest? Is wearing socks with pigs on them with a police officer's hat the correct means to protest?
Well, I don't know if I would do that, to tell you the truth, but I respect his ability to do it and his right to do it.
Larry Elder made an interesting remark when he was on the show a little while ago. He said that he believes that you should put, you know, whatever color that city happens to be, put more black people there, put more black cops there, put more white cops where there are white communities. And he was saying that. What do you think about that? Would that help the situation?
I don't think so, because I've talked to African-American people in the inner city who tell me sometimes the black cops can be more brutal towards them than the white cops. So I don't think deciding to segregate people based on color is the answer. I don't agree with Larry Elder at all on that. There are good cops and there are bad ones. We condemn the bad ones. We celebrate the good ones. That's what I was trying to tell the students at Long Beach State. You must have credibility when you attack certain elements of the police department. You must let them know that you have great respect for the good ones. But a bad one is a real bad one because they're able to use deadly force and kill people.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Now, last time you were on the show, you were adamant about Suge Knight's innocence, and you talked about it, saying that the facts would come out and prove that it was self-defense. What happened with you and Suge Knight?
I have no comment on that. I'm no longer involved in the case, and I have no further comment.
Do you have any comment on the case at all?
I do not.
Okay, so you want us to move on. You don't want us to talk about Suge Knight?
I don't represent him anymore, and I will have no comment on an ongoing case.
Okay, so when you talk about you're not representing a client anymore, how does that come about? Because isn't it true that you didn't also, you didn't represent Robert Blake to the end, did you?
No.
You did some fantastic cross-examinations in that trial.
Well, I represented Robert Blake in a 3-week televised preliminary hearing. A preliminary hearing is a hearing before a judge, not a jury, and the prosecution has an obligation to present just enough evidence to convince a judge that a case should go forward. It's called reasonable suspicion. It's called probable cause. They must establish probable cause to continue with the case. What I did was something novel. The prosecution were calling a lot of witnesses. They knew it was being televised, and I decided to treat it like a trial. So I prepared to cross-examine these witnesses from A to Z, which normally is not done at a preliminary hearing. And I was able to achieve a lot for Mr. Blake. I mean, first of all, going into that preliminary hearing, public opinion was 80%+ that he was guilty. After the end of 3 weeks following the preliminary hearing, 80%+ thought he was not guilty. Now, what I also was able to accomplish was never before had someone charged with murder with special circumstances, which potentially, you could face death in a case like that. No one had ever gotten bail over prosecution objection. I was able to get bail for Blake after attacking the witnesses the way we did in that preliminary hearing. We also got the co-defendant, Mr. Caldwell, and the conspiracy charge thrown out based on that cross-examination. And frankly, good prosecutors were removed from the case, and a less efficient prosecutor and less competent one replaced him. So we achieved a lot in that preliminary hearing. It was televised, and I think the world saw that these witnesses had problems.
You know, we had Christopher Darden on the show not too long ago, and he said a lot of things went wrong in the OJ trial, but it wasn't the fault of the prosecutors. The following week, we had Alan Dershowitz on, and he said OJ would have been guilty if they had good prosecution. Is that the way you see it?
I think OJ's lawyer, Johnny Cochran, was the greatest trial lawyer I've ever seen. I think he was a master. He was a genius. He had the intuition, the instincts, the intellect, the experience. And I think Johnny Cochran did a fantastic job in that trial, and I think he did everything he should have done. I wasn't involved in the case. Do I think the prosecutors made mistakes? Of course they did. You know, they should have solved the Furman issue very quickly by having him admit on direct examination that he had used the N-word and that it was the wrong thing to do. That would have stopped all these defense witnesses who came in to impeach him when he denied using it for the last 10
years. And Alan Dershowitz said he should never have tried that glove stunt in front of the open court.
Well, that was absurd, but there were other police mistakes. Bringing the vial of blood from Parker Center downtown back to the crime scene made no sense. There were so many mistakes that police made and prosecutors made in that case, but I don't want to take away from how good these defense lawyers were. Johnny Cochran, Barry Scheck, the DNA expert, unbelievable trial lawyers. They did a fantastic job, and they did exactly what they were hired to do.
And he's exactly where he should be, in jail. Because I believe the man was guilty, and I think you're right. I think that was the most incredible defense ever, and Johnny Cochran was amazing at what he did. But I believe when you are that criminal, and that's who you are, you're going to eventually end up in jail.
You, again, if you were at every Gervie's Law show, you would have had a chance to tell Effley Bailey that, because when he was on the show...
That was one of the shows I was so upset about missing.
Effley Bailey will go to his grave and say that OJ did not do it, and he's still saying it.
I mean, look at, though, his defense team. You know, Kardashian's dead, Cochran's dead, Effley Bailey lost his license. I mean, there's a lot of karma, and I believe in it. I'm not saying that anybody deserved to die in any way. I'm just saying this man, to me, watching him and watching this whole thing, was so guilty. It was so upsetting to watch him get off. But what they did was a brilliant job.
And also remember the time. This is over 20 years ago. Look what the black community in Los Angeles was experiencing.
Yeah.
You had the Rodney King incident, which was utter brutality by the police. You had 38th and Dalton that people have forgotten about, when police drove battering rams and knocked down innocent people's houses by mistake. They claimed they thought they were crack houses, and when they knew they'd made a mistake, they just drove away and left families to respond to it. You had the Latasha Harlins case, where this young black woman was in an argument with the owner of a liquor store, and she ended up shot in the head and killed, and the jury convicted her, the owner, of manslaughter, and she got probation. So the black community in L.A. during that period of time was extremely frustrated at the lack of justice and equality, and on top of that, here is Mr. Simpson. And you see one police officer lies about using the N-word. Other police officers, you know, bring blood where they're not supposed to bring it. You have DNA technology, which is not really well understood at the time.
Right.
And the greatest DNA lawyer in the country, Barry Scheck, on the defense side. So there's a lot of reasons why that acquittal took place.
Right here on Gervie's Law, Christopher Darden said it was the perfect storm. We have to take a break in a minute. Before we do, we need to do a tease. Carrie, I'm supposed to tease this people will come back the break. Isn't that
it's
true?
It's always good.
You're a radio professional.
My dad was the best at it.
How did he do
it? The best at it. Well, he was telling a story, told a little bit of a story, and he basically said, if you want to hear, and I'm going to quote somebody else, the rest of the story, which was not my dad, Casey Kasem, the countdown, if you listen to his stories and his dedications, he would tease, so you had to come back after the
commercial. I am going to be Casey Kasem for a second here and talk a little bit about Michael Jackson. Of course, Tom Mesro was the attorney who was able to represent Michael Jackson in his child molestation charges, and he didn't get him off. There was an acquittal. He did not get him off. I'm not going to say that again, Tom, but I do want to talk. I do. You're having a great influence on me here. I do want to talk about recent news. A guy named Wade Robson, who is a celebrity choreographer, one of your key witnesses in the 2005 trial, has just amended his complaint. It's a 2013 lawsuit against the late musician's entertainment company, MJJ Productions and MMJ Ventures. He has amended the complaint to state that Michael Jackson operated a sophisticated child sex abuse ring. Wasn't Wade Robson a witness that really helped out your case?
Absolutely. I was Michael Jackson's lead trial counsel in that five-month trial in Santa Maria, California.
Wait a second. You're saying way too much. That was our tease.
That was your tease.
That was the tease.
Well, I'm going to respond to it.
When we come back after this break, we're going to hear Tom Mesro respond to the Wade Robson accusations about a sophisticated child sex abuse ring. Remember, folks, Wade Robson testified on behalf of Michael Jackson in the 2005 trial. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
It started at bunco night. A little tickle in my throat, says Sandra. Then comes Colin barking like a seal. That cough, that's the flu. And then it spreads to Edna, to Wiley, to Marjorie. But when it comes to your door, you won't be answering because you got your flu shot at Rite Aid, where they care about you and your health. So while they're seeing doctors and sweating through fevers, you'll be teaching your granddaughter the two-deck shuffle. Shield yourself at Rite Aid before it's too late. If you're over 65, the CDC recommends flu and pneumonia shots. No appointments necessary, and they're free with Medicare Part B. Rite Aid. With us, it's personal. Flu vaccines available while supplies last. Age restrictions apply in some states. See pharmacy for details.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
Here's something to feel good about from Centrum Silver. Vitamin D was discovered in the age of dancing, the roaring 20s. Right on cue, because vitamin D plays an essential role in supporting strong bones and muscles. And just as dance moves have evolved, so is the importance of vitamin D. That's why Centrum Silver upgraded to our highest level of vitamin D3 ever.
Hey, wanna dance?
Centrum Silver, something to definitely feel good about.
Hey, it's Doug McIntyre, and believe it or not, it's already October, which means you've gone about 10 months ignoring your New Year's resolution to exercise and be more charitable. But it's not too late. Register to walk with me, my wife Penny Pizer, and the rest of Team KABC at this year's AIDS Walk Los Angeles, Sunday, October 23rd at Grand Park in downtown LA. Do something good for yourself and for others. Join Team KABC in the walk or simply donate today. For more information, go to kabc.com. See you downtown.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervey and Carrie Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
And we are back. I'm Alan Gervey. I'm here with Carrie Kasem. We are having a fascinating conversation with super lawyer Tom Mesro. He has represented some of the greatest cases. He has really had a successful record, not only blue-collar, white-collar. A little bit later, we're going to talk about his successful representation of white-collar trials and cases, real estate brokers and others in fraud cases. But before we get to that, we're going to get to the sexy part, Tom. And I know you're a straightforward guy. You have such vast knowledge. You come from a very structured background. Your father was a military guy, wasn't he?
He was a West Point graduate, as was my uncle, and I was born at the Academy. And my grandfather was a restaurateur in New York and the only honorary member of the West Point class in 1915, which was Eisenhower and General Bradley's class. So I grew up near West Point, and the Academy had a lot to do with the environment in which I was raised.
And that's why you're the stand-up guy. You're never in trouble. You're just keeping your eye on the ball when you are representing. And it's very hard representing defendants in criminal cases. I know you're used to it. You've commented in the past that celebrities may not understand the system. They may try and run you when you are their attorney, but you set them straight. You don't like having them necessarily testifying because what they say doesn't always go well with the jury.
Well, I think you have an obligation to know your client and to know the case, and you never know what's going to really happen in a courtroom. Witnesses you think that will help you don't. Witnesses you think will hurt you end up helping you. The courtroom is filled with surprises, and you have to be able to react spontaneously to unexpected developments. What I said to you was that there are some people who tend not to be good witnesses. Salesmen who do very well outside the courtroom don't often testify well. Politicians who do well outside the courtroom are often poor witnesses. And these kinds of people will think they're doing well, and they're not doing well at all. Sometimes people who are very low-key, very humble, don't have any real charisma about them, can be very effective witnesses if a jury thinks they're truthful.
You know, can you remind me of the story you told us last time you were on Gervie's Law? It stayed with me. It was really incredible where you prepared, in the Michael Jackson trial, you prepared a huge white binder with pages and pages for a cross-examination of?
Well, this is one of the problems with lawyers. Lawyers will prepare and prepare and prepare, and they'll put so much time into that preparation that when they get into a courtroom, they're reluctant to not use it. What happened was Michael Jackson's ex-wife, Debbie Rowe, was going to testify for the prosecution. I had about 20 binders of documents, all in chronological order, every paper from their divorce, every recording, every newspaper article about her, and I was really prepared to go at it. What I found out was, as soon as she testified, she was helping Michael Jackson, not hurting him, and I didn't want to upset her and go after her. She appeared very nervous, very unstable in some ways, but very moved by the fact that that she really loved Michael Jackson and thought he was a good father and didn't think he was a guilty person. So I scuttled all 20 binders, didn't use one of them or one document in them. Point I'm making is I've seen lawyers prepare, and then once they get into a courtroom, instead of reacting the way I did, they'll just start examining from the documents they worked so hard
on.
And that's not the point.
Yeah, I grew up with people who grew up with Michael Jackson as very young kids, entertainers. And all of them, to this day, said none of that ever happened. They never saw any of it. They spent the night with him. They hung out with him. Some of them actually went on tour with them and was on the bus. None of that happened. And I always thought Michael Jackson was innocent because years later now, most of the time, and not all the time, but a lot of times, if you've been accused of molesting all these boys, one or two or maybe more are going to get older and come back and say, look, this is what this man did. And you've never heard that. At least I haven't. You've never seen that. And how many kids did he? He just loved children. And
all right, well, we're not going to get into what he did.
I know. But I want to ask him, Alan, I want to ask him, to you, meeting the man, what was your feeling when you first met this man?
Well, I walk into a case with no expectations and no conclusions. I don't want to believe the media necessarily. I don't want to believe anybody. I want to make up my own mind. So I spent time with him, and I asked him questions that I thought were significant, the kinds of questions that I thought would reveal what kind of a person he was. And I have to tell you, I decided pretty quickly this man was no child molester. He was no pedophile. He was being used and manipulated throughout his life by all kinds of people. And this situation was no different.
So now, Wade Robson, who testified on Michael's behalf, and another fellow named James Safechuck have come out in allegations against the Michael Jackson MJJ Ventures and Productions and said things like he was running a ring of molestation. They were running a ring of molestation. They attracted and lured and seduced child sexual abuse victims. In fact, James Safechuck has said that Jackson had code words that he used to safeguard their secret. He said, this is Safechuck talking, he referred to an erection as Bright Lights Brick City and semen as duck butter. And he also said that he would touch Mr. Safechuck's hand in a certain way, indicating he wanted sex. Now, in the original trial, Wade Robson actually testified on Michael's behalf. Isn't that true, Tom?
Well, I called him as our first witness in the defense case. I was Michael Jackson's lead trial lawyer, and I'll tell you, when the prosecution rested their case, we had been so effective in cross-examination with their witnesses that I had to think long and hard about whether I was going to put on a defense case. Because when you put on a defense case, you also, your witnesses run the risk of cross-examination.
Right.
I decided that we probably would get a hung jury if I rested, which I didn't want Michael going through another retrial, you know. So I decided to put on a defense case. And when you do that, you want to start strong and you want to end strong. I started with Wade Robson as a witness. I had met with him. I met with his mother. I met with his sister. I called all three as witnesses in the defense case. And all three were very powerful witnesses under oath, testifying, in effect, that they saw no wrongdoing ever by Michael Jackson. And Wade was my first witness because I found him so credible and so powerful in his statements that he was never touched and never molested.
So what gives?
Well, I personally, it's my opinion, this is just a money grab.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's saying that both of them are saying they went through psychotherapy over the last few years, and this is just coming out. They needed a reason to change their stories, and I guess the psychotherapy does it. But it's so strong when they have such specific allegations. How do you deal with that? Do you think that Michael Jackson Ventures is in trouble with these specific allegations?
No, I don't. As long as they stick to their guns and try the case, I have my doubts as to whether they'll do that. Now, one of Robson's lawsuits was thrown out. The one against the companies apparently is still in existence.
Right.
I'm not involved in the case, but I hope the estate lawyers will stick to their guns and fight this all the way. I have my doubts about that because the lawyer for the estate is Howard Weitzman, who settled the 93 case where Michael Jackson paid a reported $20 million to end the litigation. Weitzman's signature is on the settlement document. He appeared at a press conference to announce it. And I have my doubts as to whether he'll have the guts to try the thing or whether John Branca, the trustee of the estate, will have the guts to try that if they have to.
If they called you, would you jump in?
I would never settle a case like that.
Yeah, but would you try the case? If Weissman calls you and says, I'm not capable of trying this case, I need Mesro. He was successful in 2005. Would you take the case?
I would certainly talk about it. You know, I would have to find out what conditions we were going to operate in, what the terms were for the representation, et cetera. But would I defend Michael again? Of course I would.
You know, we're just going to switch gears, and this is something that I think Carrie is very interested in. And there is word on the internet, and who knows whether that's true or not, that former Playboy Playmate, actually Playboy Playmate Danny Mathers, who I think was the Playmate of the Year in 2015, and also worked at this station.
For Heidi and Frank.
For Heidi and
yes.
Frank, that she may be charged for taking a selfie with a woman in the background at LA Fitness who had no clothes on. I think she was 62 years old.
70, I think.
Really?
I think she was 70.
Okay, whatever.
So.
I'm
70.
Anyway, the issue is body shaming. And your name, Tom, has been connected with Danny Mathers. I'm not going to call it a case, but situation, whether you would represent her. It's a unique circumstances to have allegations and to have criminal activity.
Well, I represent Danny Mathers. She's a very, very nice person. I know that she never tried to hurt anybody or intended to violate any law. She never thought she was violating any law and never tried to hurt anyone, and that's all I'm going to say.
Carrie, what are you going to say?
Look, she's in that world where everything that matters is what you look like. That's, unfortunately, she is in that world. So I don't think that she's, look, I don't know her at all. She's probably not a vicious, evil person, but that was a mean, mean thing to do. And I think if she would have just come out and said, I apologize, that
she
was
did.
Or, no.
She apologized.
She said, in a way, but she also said that it didn't mean to go out publicly. It meant to go to a friend. I don't believe that for one second. If she would have come out and said, I did a horribly mean thing, that sucked. That was awful. I apologize. I think a lot of this would have gone away, but she really didn't. She went around an apology, and I think she lied. But do I think she's an evil person? No. I think she's caught up in a world that deals with who you are is your body.
Tom, is dissemination of private images going to be a crime of the future?
I don't want to comment on that because I'm representing Ms. Mathers.
The question wasn't about Ms. Mathers. Okay. I'm just talking about this unique situation. Dissemination of private images from a cell phone, from a selfie, on chat, on Instagram, whatever.
At this time, I'll decline to respond to that, except to say that Ms. Mathers never tried to violate any law or hurt anybody, and she did apologize.
She did apologize. It's interesting, and I know that we're going to hear more, not only about the Mathers case, but at other cases, because we're seeing it starting very young with children who are abusing, I believe, social media and are not, you know, it's bullying. They're not taking into consideration other people's rights.
No further comment.
And that's how we're going to end this segment. We have one more segment. Tom is smiling. For those of you who think he's beating me up right now, he does have a smile on his face. He is the ultimate attorney. He is able to make his point without any emotion, just doing it like you're supposed to, how you learn. But I'll tell you, there's an intangible. Tom Mesro has an intangible that a lot of lawyers don't have. They should take lessons from him. When we had Jerry Spence on the show, he talked about connecting with the human side of people. Tom Mesereau, you connect with the human side of people. Isn't that where it's at? We only have 30 seconds.
I think humanizing your client and showing the jury what kind of a person the client is very, very important, and many lawyers don't do it very well.
Exactly. You need to start a school in that, and I think that's something. I know you're too busy already, but it's something that Jerry Spence did with his school, and lawyers need to learn. They really need to learn how to humanize their clients and humanize the jury and everyone else, other attorneys on the case. You listen to Gervie's Law. We will be right back after this.
Ready for a breakfast combo that'll make your taste buds sing? Try Norm's Fruit-Topped Hotcake Serenade. Two light and fluffy buttermilk hotcakes made from scratch with the freshest ingredients. The Fruit-Topped Hotcake Serenade comes with your choice of strawberries, blueberries, or cinnamon-spiced apples. Served with two farm-fresh eggs, two strips of hickory-smoked bacon, two sausage links, and crisp golden hash browns. Starting at just $7.99 for a limited time only. Morning, noon, or night, breakfast is always right. It's the Norm. Normsrestaurants.com. Open 24/7.
We pay the sales tax Saturday, Sunday, and Monday at Orchard Supply Hardware. Save store-wide and get fall off to a fantastic start. Save even more with great deals like 10% off all plastic sheds. All Weber Genesis gas grills are $100 off. And Rust-Oleum Painter's Touch 2X spray paint is now two cans for only $6. We pay the sales tax, you get the savings. October 8th to the 10th at Orchard Supply Hardware. Visit Osh.com to find a store near you.
Say, what is
it? You're listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yes, you are listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. We are talking with Tom Mesereau, and we have talked a lot today about Tom's accomplishments. And if people think that I am just trumping him up, that's a poor choice of words, it's not true. Ricky Kleeman, who's analyst, legal analyst, CBS Early Morning Show, and married to former police chief of L.A. and New York, Bill Bratton, said that Tom Mesereau deserves all the praise he gets. So we're not just making this up, folks. He has represented some of the most notorious people charged with crimes and celebrities, a lot of celebrities. We just talked about the Michael Jackson case. And we want to switch gears here for a few minutes, Tom, and talk about white-collar crime. Because we've talked about all these cases that have been in the news. There are a lot of white-collar crimes that we don't read about. And you have now, over the last 5 or 6 years, been successful in 4 federal white-collar trials, which is really unheard of. Tell us about these cases. There's Jason Patterson and the Babajan? I can't
pronounce it. Joe Babajan.
Babajan.
Yes.
Yeah.
Joe was the highest-grossing real estate agent in the country at one point. He sold homes to many celebrities, David Beckham, Janet Jackson, Beyonce, Nicolas Cage, Bruce Willis, Barbara Streisand, and a very talented, extremely hardworking man who was wrongfully accused by a federal grand jury, which indicted him on 21 counts of what I call collectively mortgage fraud. The allegations were conspiracy, bank fraud, loan fraud, wire fraud. And they alleged that he was part of a conspiracy to defraud Lehman Brothers, formerly of one of the most powerful investment banks in the world, of up to $40 million. He pleaded not guilty. He was represented by a big national law firm that, in my opinion, really did not do a very good job defending him. He came to me. I agreed to defend him. We went to trial in United States District Court in Los Angeles. It's a central district. And the jury did not convict him on a single count. They acquitted him of 13 felony counts. They hung on the remaining 8 counts. And the government could have retried the 8 hung counts, but instead they took a misdemeanor and no jail time. And he walked out of there free. And he's, again, one of the most successful real estate agents in the country and a wonderful guy.
Yeah, and I apologize for Joe. I mean, my name isn't that easy to pronounce either. How about you?
No, I couldn't even pronounce his last name. I could give you his first, though.
Joe.
Yeah, Joe.
You were going to ask Tom something.
About Joe?
No, I don't know what it was about. I'm not in your head.
No, that was like two segments ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not about Joe.
No, we were actually talking back about the Michael Jackson case, and I answered it off air. So if we were to get back into that conversation, we'd have to recap everything.
I want to talk about doctors, because I know you've represented doctors in administrative law hearings. As a workers' compensation lawyer, what I do is I appear in front of administrative law judges. The WCAB, which is the Workers' Compensation Appeals Board, is an administrative entity. There are different rules, different consequences. I have become an expert in that area. And I know that in representing doctors, you now have become an expert in helping doctors who have been accused of not crimes, but of, let's say, transgressions that could take away their licenses.
Well, I represent physicians who are charged with crimes. I also represent physicians who are facing medical board discipline. And what happens is if the California Medical Board wants to discipline a physician's license, they will bring what is called an accusation against the doctor. And if a trial takes place, if it can't be resolved, the trial is before an administrative law judge. The medical board is represented by the California Attorney General's office. The trial takes place at the Office of Administrative Hearings. The judge ultimately decides whether the defendant is guilty or not. And it's a full-blown trial without a jury. You're in front of a judge.
Right.
And I have had success in those cases.
How do you get those cases? Because it sounds like you're so busy. Are you walking around the streets with a sign and says, I defend anyone?
Hardly. No, I have a reputation that I think is pretty good. I hope it's good.
Well, I've been effective. Ricky Kleeman thinks so.
Well,
amongst others.
I hope she's correct.
I think she is.
And I like representing physicians. I think very often the Attorney General's office will go after physicians with a very thin knowledge of what they really do. And I have been effective in these trials.
What about with sexual conduct? Does that make it difficult when they're accused of unprofessional touching?
I did represent a plastic surgeon who was accused of improper sexual contact with patients. He was acquitted of all those charges by the administrative law judge. And yes, the medical board, through the California Attorney General, will go after physicians in administrative proceedings who they believe have engaged in improper sexual behavior.
Now, isn't it hard if you're doing a woman's breasts or you're doing certain parts of
Wait
a woman's
body? Isn't it hard if you're doing a woman's breasts?
If you're a plastic surgeon, come on now, and you're touching and you're doing all of that. Oh, that seems like an easy lawsuit for a woman to walk in and say, this man, he inappropriately touched me. Yes, I came there, but I'm expecting a doctor, not somebody to fondle me. It just kind of almost leaves you open to a lawsuit.
I totally agree with you. And in our defense, we also called a number of female patients who thought this doctor walked on water and testified to his good character and his professional behavior. So I totally agree with everything you just said. It's an easy accusation to make. And unfortunately, we live in a society where a lot of false accusations are made.
Right.
So we only have a couple minutes left. What's next for Tom Mesro? You've accomplished so much. How do you see yourself progressing in your career as you move forward?
You know, I think one of the differences between me and other trial lawyers is my attitude is I'm always learning. I'm always growing. Too many arrogant, self-centered lawyers think that I should be teaching you, not the reverse. I'm always learning from my clients. I'm always learning from juries. I'm always learning from every trial I do. And I hope to do that till I drop.
Till you drop? You're not going to retire?
I don't think so.
You know, my dad always said that if you're not learning, you're dead. And he always learned from people, even though people said he was the best. If he would have thought that he was the best, he would have never gotten better or never learned anything more. So I think that's a great way to look at life.
I'm always reading new books about cases. I'm always studying what other lawyers do. And I think I'm in the best profession in the world.
Isn't it ironic that that's how it really started for you? Reading, the voracious reader that you are of criminal trials and lawyers, and that's how you really got into it, and that's what you're still doing how many years later?
I still do it. I started doing it in law school, and what I have found is I'll go back and reread a book that I read 5 years ago, and in light of my experiences and changes in my life, I see things in a different light, and different aspects of the book will have more significance to me. I'm lucky. I'm always growing. I'm always learning, and that's what I want to do for the rest of my life.
Now, we had John Henry Brown on not too long ago, and he defended Ted Bundy. Are there any other lawyers that you would suggest we have on this show who have done, you know, some incredible jobs with difficult criminal or clients?
I think you should talk to Brian Stevenson from Alabama, who wrote a wonderful book recently. He's a Harvard Law School graduate who decided to devote his life to the poor in the Deep South, primarily capital murder cases. Fabulous lawyer, really doing God's work and making a difference. He's someone that I would suggest you talk to.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We will do it. We will contact him. We want to thank you, Tom Mesro, for being on Gervie's Law. Fascinating, fascinating hour.
Thank you for having me. I've been honored.
Thank you.
And we want to thank everyone for listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. We'll see you next week.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.